and without putting his coat back on, he clambered up over the rocks to do so. His hands were numb, and the climb was more arduous than he'd anticipated, but the scene above and below him when he reached the top of the rock was worth the effort. No wonder Hapexamendios had come here on his way to his resting place. Even gods might be inspired by such grandeur. The peaks of the Jokalelau receded in apparently infinite procession, their white slopes faintly gilded by the heavens they reached for. The silence could not have been more utter. This vantage point served a practical as well as an aesthetic purpose. The high pass was plainly visible, and so, some distance off to the right, was a sight perplexing enough for him to call the Mischief up from its work. A glacier, its surface shimmering, lay a mile or more from the rock, but it wasn't the spectacle of such frozen enormity that claimed Gentle's eye. It was the presence within the ice of a litter of darker forms.
"You want to go and find out what they are?"
the Mischief said, washing its blooded hands in the snow.
"I think we should," Gentle replied. "If we're walking in the Unbeheld's footsteps, we should make it our business to see what he saw."
"Or what he caused," Pi said.
They descended, and Gentle put his shirt and coat back on. The clothes were warm, having been left beside the fire, and he was glad of that comfort, but they also stank of his sweat and of the animals whose backs they'd been stripped from, and he half wished he could go naked rather than be burdened by another hide.
"Have you finished with the skinning?"
Gentle asked Pi as they set off, going by foot rather than waste the energies of their remaining vehicle.
"I've done what I can," Pi replied, "but it's crude. I'm no butcher."
"Are you a cook?" Gentle asked.
"Not really. Why do you ask?"
"I've been thinking about food a lot, that's all. You know, after this trip I may never eat meat again. The fat, the gristle, it turns my stomach thinking about it."
"You've got a sweet tooth,"
you noticed. "I'd kill for a plate of profiteroles right now, swimming in chocolate sauce."
He laughed.
"Listen to me. The glories of Jokalelau laid before us, and I'm obsessing on profiteroles."
Then again, deadly serious,
"Do they have chocolate in his orderings?"
"By now I'm sure they do. But my people eat plainly, so I never got an addiction for sugar. Fish, on the other hand."
"Fish," said Gentle, "I've no taste for it."
"You'll get one in his orderings. There's restaurants down by the harbour."
The Mischief's talk turned into a smile.
"Now I'm sounding like you. We must both be sick of doikai meat."
"Go on," Gentle said. "I want to see you salivate."
"There are restaurants down by the harbour where the fish is so fresh it's still flapping when they take it into the kitchen."
"That's a recommendation."
"There's nothing in the world as good as fresh fish," Pi said. "If the catch is good, you've got a choice of 40, maybe 50 dishes, from tiny jeppas to squeffa my size and bigger."
"Is there anything I'd recognize?"
"A few species. Why travel all this way for a cod steak when you could have squeffa? Or better, there's a dish I have to order for you. It's a fish called an ogachi, which is almost as small as a jeppas, and it lives in the belly of another fish."
"That sounds suicidal."
"Wait, there's more. The second fish is often eaten whole by a bloater called a koliachik. They're ugly, but the meat melts like butter. So if you're lucky, they'll grill all three of them together, just the way they were caught."
"One inside the other?"
"Head, tail, the whole caboodle."
"That's disgusting."
"And if you're very lucky, Pi, the ogachi's a female, and you find, when you cut through all three layers of fish,
her belly's full of caviar."
"You guessed it. Doesn't that sound tempting?"
"I'll stay with my chocolate mousse and ice cream."
"How is it you're not fat?"
"Vanessa used to say I had the palate of a child, the libido of an adolescent, and the... well, you can guess the rest. I sweated out making love. Or at least I used to."
They were close to the edge of the glacier now, and their talk of fish and chocolate ceased, replaced by a grim silence, as the identity of the forms encased in the ice became apparent. They were human bodies, a dozen or more. Ice locked around them, a collection of debris. Fragments of blue stone, immense bowls of beaten metal, the remnants of garments, the blood on them still bright. Gentle clambered and skidded across the top of the glacier until the bodies were directly beneath him. Some were buried too deeply to be studied, but those closer to the surface, faces upturned, limbs fixed in attitudes of desperation, were almost too visible. They were all women. The youngest, barely out of childhood, the oldest, a naked, many-breasted hag who'd perished with her eyes still open, her stare preserved for the millennium. Some massacre had occurred here, or farther up the mountain, and the evidence been thrown into this river while it still flowed. Then apparently it had frozen around the victims and their belongings.
"Who are they?" Gentle asked. "Any idea?"
Though they were dead, the past tense didn't seem appropriate for corpses so perfectly preserved.
"When the Unbeheld passed through the dominions, he overthrew all the cults he deemed unworthy. Most of them were sacred to goddesses. Their oracles and devotees were women."
"So you think Hepaxamendios did this?
If not him, then his agents, his righteous. Though on second thought he's supposed to have walked here alone, so maybe this is his handiwork."
"Then whoever he is,"
Gentle said, looking down at the child in the ice,
"he's a murderer, no better than you or me."
"I wouldn't say that too loudly," Pye advised.
"Why not? He's not here.
If this is his doing, he may have left entities to watch over it."
Gentle looked around. The air could not have been clearer. There was no sign of motion on the peaks or the snowfields gleaming below.
"If they're here, I don't see them," he said.
"The worst are the ones you can't see," Pye replied. "Shall we go back to the fire?"
2. They were weighed down by what they'd seen, and the return journey took longer than the outward. By the time they made the safety of their niche in the rocks, to welcoming grunts from the surviving Doekai, the sky was losing its golden sheen and dusk was on its way. They debated whether to proceed in darkness and decided against it. Though the air was calm at present, they knew from past experience that conditions on these heights were unpredictable. If they attempted to move by night and a storm descended from the peaks, they'd be twice blinded and in danger of losing their way. With the high pass so close and the journey easier, they hoped, once they were through it, the risk was not worth taking. Having used up the supply of wood they collected below the snow line, they were obliged to fuel the fire with the dead Doekai's saddle and harness. It made for a smoky, pungent, and fitful blaze. But it was better than nothing. They cooked some of the fresh meat, Gentle observing as he chewed that he had less compunction about eating something he'd named than he thought, and brewed up a small serving of the herder's piss liquor. As they drank, Gentle returned the conversation to the women in the ice.
"Why would a god as powerful as Hepaxamendios slaughter defenseless women?"
"Whoever said they were defenseless," Pye replied. "I think they were probably very powerful. Their oracles must have sensed what was coming, so they had their armies ready."
"Armies of women?"
"Certainly. Warriors in their tens of thousands. There are places to the north of the Lantern Way where the earth used to move every 50 years or so and uncover one of their war graves."
"They were all slaughtered? The armies? The oracles?
Or driven so deep into hiding they forgot who they were after a few generations? Don't look so surprised. It happens."
"One god defeats how many goddesses? 10? 20?
Innumerable."
"How?"
"He was one, and simple. They were many, and diverse."
"Singularity is strength,
at least in the short term." "Who told you that?"
"I'm trying to remember. Somebody I didn't like much. Klein, maybe."
"Whoever said it, it's true. Hepaxamendios came into the dominions with a seductive idea that wherever you went, whatever misfortune attended you, you needed only one name on your lips, one prayer, one altar, and you'd be in his care. And he brought a species to maintain that order once he'd established it. Yours."
"Those women back there looked human enough to me."
"So do I," Pye reminded him. "But I'm not."
"No. You're pretty diverse, aren't you?"
"I was once."
"So that puts you on the side of the goddesses, doesn't it?"
Gentle whispered. The mistiff put its finger to his lips. Gentle mouthed one word by way of response.
Heretic.
It was very dark now, and they both settled to studying the fire. It was steadily diminishing as the last of Chester's saddle was consumed.
Maybe we should burn some fur, Gentle suggested.
No, said Pye. Let it dwindle. But keep looking.
At what?
Anything.
There's only you to look at.
Then look at me.
He did so. The privations of the last many days had seemingly taken little toll on the mischief. It had no facial hair to disfigure the symmetry of its features, nor had their Spartan diet pinched its cheeks or hollowed its eyes. Studying its face was like returning to a favourite painting in a museum. There it was, a thing of calm and beauty. But unlike the painting, the face before him, which presently seemed so solid, had the capacity for infinite change. It was months since the night when he'd first seen that phenomenon. But now, as the fire burned itself out and the shadows deepened around them, he realized the same sweet miracle was imminent. The flicker of dying flame made the symmetry swim. The flesh before him seemed to lose its fixedness as he stared and stirred it.
I want to watch, he murmured.
Then watch.
But the fire's going out.
We don't need light to see each other, the mischief whispered. Hold on to the sight.
Gentle concentrated, studying the face before him. His eyes ached as he tried to hold on to it, but they were no competition for the swelling darkness.
Stop looking,
Pye said, in a voice that seemed to rise from the decay of the embers.
Stop looking and see.
Gentle fought for the sense of this, but it was no more susceptible to analysis than the darkness in front of him. Two senses were failing him here, one physical, one linguistic, two ways to embrace the world slipping from him at the same moment. It was like a little death, and a panic seized him, like the fear he'd felt some midnights, waking in his bed and body and knowing neither. His bones a cage, his blood a gruel, his dissolution the only certainty. At such times he'd turned on all the lights for their comfort, but there were no lights here. Only bodies, growing colder as the fire died.
Help me,
he said. The mischief didn't speak.
Are you there, Pye? I'm afraid. Touch me, will you? Pye?
The mischief didn't move. Gentle started to reach out in the darkness, remembering as he did so the sight of Taylor, lying on a pillow from which they'd both known he'd never rise again, asking for Gentle to hold his hand. With that memory, the panic became sorrow. For Taylor, for Clem, for every soul sealed from its loved ones by senses born to failure, himself included. He wanted what the child wanted, knowledge of another presence proved in touch. But he knew it was no real solution. He might find the mischief in the darkness, but he could no more hold on to its flesh forever than he could hold the senses he'd already lost. Nerves decayed and fingers slipped from fingers at the last. Knowing this little solace was as hopeless as any other, he withdrew his hand and instead said,
I love you.
Or did he simply think it? Perhaps it was thought, because it was the idea rather than the syllables that formed in front of him. The iridescence he remembered from Pye's transforming self shimmering in a darkness that was not, he vaguely understood, the darkness of the starless night, but his mind's darkness, and this seeing not the business of eye and object, but his exchange with a creature he loved, and who loved him back. He let his feelings go to Pye, if there was indeed a going which he doubted. Space, like time, belonged to the other tale, to the tragedy of separation they'd left behind. Stripped of his senses and their necessities, almost unborn again, he knew the mischief's comfort as it knew his, and that dissolution he'd woken in terror of so many times stood revealed as the beginning of bliss. A gust of wind, blowing between the rocks, caught the embers at their side, and their glow became a momentary flame. It brightened the face in front of him, and the sight summoned him back from his unborn state. It was no great hardship to return. The place they'd found together was out of time and could not decay, and the face in front of him, for all its frailty, or perhaps because of it, was beautiful to look at. Pi smiled at him, but said nothing.
"We should sleep," Gentle said. "We've got a long way to go tomorrow."
Another gust came along, and there were flecks of snow in it, stinging Gentle's face. He pulled the hood of his coat up over his head and got up to check on the welfare of the Doekai. It had made a shallow bed for itself in the snow and was asleep. By the time he got back to the fire, which had found some combustible morsel and was devouring it brightly, the mastiff was also asleep, its hood pulled up around its head. As he stared down at the visible crescent of Pi's face, a simple thought came. That though the wind was moaning at the rock, ready to bury them, and there was death in the valley behind, and a city of atrocities ahead, he was happy. He lay down on the hard ground beside the mastiff. His last thought, as sleep came, was of Taylor, lying on a pillow which was becoming a snowfield as he drew his final breaths, his face growing translucent and finally disappearing, so that when Gentle slipped from consciousness, it was not into darkness, but into the whiteness of that deathbed turned to untrodden snow. Chapter 23. 1. Gentle dreamed that the wind grew harsher and brought snow down off the peaks, fresh minted. He nevertheless rose from the relative comfort of his place beside the ashes and took off his coat and shirt, took off his boots and socks, took off his trousers and underwear, and naked walked down the narrow corridor of rock past the sleeping Doekai to face the blast. Even in dreams the wind threatened to freeze his marrow, but he had his sights set on the glacier, and he had to go to it in all humility, bare-loined, bare-backed, to show due respect for those souls who suffered there. They had endured centuries of pain, the crime against them unrevenged. Beside theirs, his suffering was a minor thing. There was sufficient light in the wide sky to show him his way, but the wastes seemed endless, and the gusts worsened as he went, several times throwing him over into the snow. His muscles cramped and his breath shortened, coming from between his numbed lips in hard, small clouds. He wanted to weep for the pain of it, but the tears crystallized on the ledge of his eye and would not fall. Twice he stopped, because he sensed that there was something more than snow on the storm's back. He remembered Pi's talk of agents left in this wilderness to guard the murder site, and though he was only dreaming and knew it, he was still afraid. If these entities were charged to keep witnesses from the glacier, they would not simply drive the wakeful off, but the sleeping too. And those who came as he came in reverence would earn their special ire. He studied the spattered air, looking for some sign of them, and once thought he glimpsed a form overhead that would have been invisible but that it displaced the snow. An eel's body with a tiny ball of a head. But it was come and gone too quickly for him to be certain he'd even seen it. The glacier was in sight, however, and his will drove his limbs to motion until he was standing at its edge. He raised his hands to his face and wiped the snow from his cheeks and forehead, then stepped onto the ice. The women gazed up at him as they had when he'd stood here with Pi O'Par. But now, through the dust of snow blowing across the ice, they saw him naked, his manhood shrunk, his body trembling. On his face and lips, a question he had half an answer to. Why, if this was indeed the work of Hypaxamendios, had the unbeheld, with all his powers of destruction, not obliterated every last sign of his victims? Was it because they were women, or, more particularly, women of power? Had he brought them to ruin as best he could, overturning their altars and unseating their temples, but at the last been unable to wipe them away? And if so, was this ice a grave or merely a prison? He dropped to his knees and laid his palms on the glacier. This time he definitely heard a sound in the wind, a raw howl somewhere overhead. The invisibles had entertained his dreaming presence long enough. They saw his purpose and were circling in preparation for descent. He blew against his palm and made a fist before the breath could slip, then raised his arm and slammed his hand against the ice, opening it as he did so. The pneuma went off like a thunderclap. Before the tremors had died, he snatched a second breath and broke it against the ice, then a third and fourth in quick succession, striking the steely surface so hard that had the pneuma not cushioned the blow, he'd have broken every bone from wrist to fingertip. But his efforts had effect. There were hairline cracks spreading from the point of impact. Encouraged, he began a second round of blows, but he delivered only three when he felt something take hold of his hair, wrenching his head back. A second grip instantly seized his raised arm. He had time to feel the ice splintering beneath his legs. Then he was hauled up off the glacier by wrist and hair. He struggled against the claim, knowing that if his assaulters carried him too high, death was assured. They'd either tear him apart in the clouds or simply drop him. The hold on his head was the less secure of the two, and his gyrations were sufficient to slip it, though blood ran down his brow. Freed, he looked up at the entities. There were two, 6 feet long, their bodies scantily fleshed spines sprouting innumerable ribs, their limbs 12-fold and bereft of bone, their heads vestigial. Only their motion had beauty, a sinuous knotting and unknotting. He reached up and snatched at the closer of the two heads. Though it had no discernible features, it looked tender, and his hand had sufficient echo of the pneumas it had discharged to do harm. He dug his fingers into the flesh of the thing, and it instantly began to writhe, coiling its length around its companion for support, its limbs flailing wildly. He twisted his body to the left and right, the motion violent enough to wrench him free. Then he fell, a mere 6 feet, but hard, onto slivered ice. The breath went from him as the pain came. He had time to see the agents descending upon him, but none in which to escape. Waking or sleeping, this was the end of him, he knew. Death by these limbs had jurisdiction in both states. But before they could find his flesh and blind him and unman him, he felt the shattered glacier beneath him shudder. And with a roar it rose, throwing him off its back into the snow. Shards pelted down upon him, but he peered up through their hail to see that the women were emerging from their graves, clothed in ice. He hauled himself to his feet as the tremors increased, the din of this unshackling echoing off the mountains. Then he turned and ran. The storm was discreet and quickly drew its veil over the resurrection, so that he fled not knowing how the events he'd begun had finished. Certainly the agents of Hapexamendios made no pursuit, or if they did, they failed to find him. Their absence comforted him only a little. His adventures had done him harm, and the distance he had to cover to get back to the camp was substantial. His run soon deteriorated into stumbling and staggering, blood marking his route. It was time to be done with this dream of endurance, he thought, and open his eyes, to roll over and put his arms around Pai Opa, to kiss the mischief's cheek and share this vision with it. But his thoughts were too confounded to take hold of wakefulness long enough for him to rouse himself, and he dared not lie down in the snow in case a dreamed death came to him before morning woke him. All he could do was push himself on, weaker by the step, putting out of his head the possibility that he'd lost his way and that the camp didn't lie ahead, but off in another direction entirely. He was looking down at his feet when he heard the shout, and his first instinct was to peer up into the snow above him, expecting one of the unbeheld's creatures. But before his eyes reached his zenith, they found the shape approaching him from his left. He stopped and studied the figure. It was shaggy and hooded, but its arms were outspread in invitation. He didn't waste what little energy he had, calling Pai's name. He simply changed his direction and headed towards the mischief as it came to meet him. It was the faster of the two, and as it came it shrugged off its coat and held it open, so that he fell into its luxury. He couldn't feel it. Indeed, he could feel little except relief. Borne up by the mischief, he let all conscious thought go, the rest of the journey becoming a blur of snow and snow, and Pai's voice, sometimes at his side, telling him that it would be over soon.
Am I awake?
He opened his eyes and sat up, grasping hold of Pi's coat to do so.
Am I awake?
Yes.
Thank God. Thank God. I thought I was going to freeze to death.
He let his head sink back. The fire was burning, fed with fur, and he could feel its warmth on his face and body. It took a few seconds to realize the significance of this. Then he sat up again, and realized he was naked, naked and covered with cuts.
I'm not awake, he said. Shit, I'm not awake!
Pi took the pot of herder's brew from the fire and poured a cup.
You didn't dream it, the mistiff said.
It handed the cup over to Gentle.
You went to the glacier, and you almost didn't make it back.
Gentle took the cup in raw fingers.
I must have been out of my mind, he said. I remember thinking, I'm dreaming this, then taking off my coat and my clothes. Why the hell did I do that?
He could still recall struggling through the snow and reaching the glacier. He remembered pain and splintering ice, but the rest had receded so far he couldn't grasp it. Pi read his perplexed look.
Don't try and remember now, the mistiff said. It'll come back when the moment's right. Push too hard and you'll break your heart. You should sleep for a while.
I don't fancy sleeping, he said. It's a little too much like dying.
I'll be here, Pi told him. Your body needs rest. Let it do what it needs to do.
The mistiff had been warming Gentle's shirt in front of the fire, and now helped him put it on. A delicate business. Gentle's joints were already stiffening. He pulled on his trousers without Pi's help, however, up over limbs that were a mass of bruises and abrasions.
Whatever I did out there, I certainly made a mess of myself, he remarked.
You'll heal quickly, Pi said.
This was true, though Gentle couldn't remember sharing that information with the mistiff.
Lie down. I'll wake you when it's light.
Gentle put his head on the small heap of hides Pi had made as a pillow and let the mistiff pull his coat up over him.
Dream of sleeping, Pi said, laying a hand on Gentle's face. And wake whole.
2. When Pi shook him awake, what seemed mere minutes later, the sky visible between the rock faces was still dark, but it was the gloom of snow-bearing cloud, rather than the purple-black of a Joko-Leilaurian night. He sat up feeling wretched, aching in every bone.
I'd kill for coffee, he said,
resisting the urge to torture his joints by stretching.
And warm pan au chocolat.
If they don't have it in Isodorex, we'll invent it, Pi said.
Did you brew up?
There's nothing left to burn.
And what's the weather like?
Don't ask.
That bad?
We should get a move on. The thicker the snow gets, the more difficult it'll be to find the pass.
They roused the Doikai, which made plain its disgruntlement at having to breakfast on words of encouragement rather than hay, and, with the meat Pi had prepared the day before loaded, left the shelter of the rock and headed out into the snow. There had been a short debate before they left as to whether they should ride or not, Pi insisting that Gentle should do so given his present delicacy, but he'd argued that they might need the Doekai's strength to carry them both if they got into worse difficulties, and they should preserve such energies as it still possessed for such an emergency. But he soon began to stumble in snow that was waist-high in places, his body, though somewhat healed by sleep, not equal to the demands upon it.
"We'll go more quickly if you ride," Pi told him.
He needed little persuasion and mounted the Doekai, his fatigue such that he could barely sit upright with the wind so strong, and instead slumped against the beast's neck. He only occasionally raised himself from that posture, and when he did, the scene had scarcely changed.
"Shouldn't we be in the pass by now?"
he murmured to Pi at one point, and the look on the mistiff's face was answer enough. They were lost. Gentle pushed himself into an upright position and, squinting against the gale, looked for some sign of shelter, however small. The world was white in every direction but for them, and even they were being steadily erased as ice clogged the fur of their coats and the snow they were trudging through deepened. Until now, however arduous the journey had become, he hadn't countenanced the possibility of failure. He'd been his own best convert to the gospel of their indestructibility, but now such confidence seemed self-deception. The white world would strip all colour from them to get to the purity of their bones. He reached to take hold of Pai's shoulder, but misjudged the distance and slid from the Doekai's back. Relieved of its burden, the beast slumped, its front legs buckling. Had Pai not been swift and pulled Gentle out of harm's way, he might have been crushed beneath the creature's bulk. Hauling back his hood and swiping the snow from the back of his neck, he got to his feet and found Pai's exhausted gaze there to meet him.
"I thought I was leading us right," the mistiff said. "Of course you did. But we've missed the bar somehow. The slope's getting steeper. I don't know where the fuck we are, Gentle."
"In trouble is where we are, and too tired to think our way out of it. We have to rest."
"Where?"
"Here," Gentle said. "This blizzard can't go on forever. There's only so much snow in the sky, and most of it's already fallen, right? Right? So if we can just hold on till the storm's over, and we can see where we are.
Suppose by that time it's night again. We'll freeze, my friend."
"Do we have any other choice?" Gentle said. "If we go on, we'll kill the beast and probably ourselves. We could march right over a gorge and never know it. But if we stay here, together, maybe we're in with a chance."
"I thought I knew our direction."
"Maybe you did. Maybe the storm will blow over and we'll find ourselves on the other side of the mountain."
Gentle put his hands on Pai's shoulders, sliding them around the back of the mistiff's neck.
"We have no choice," he said slowly.
Pai nodded, and together they settled as best they could in the dubious shelter of the Doekai's body. The beast was still breathing, but not, Gentle thought, for long. He tried to put from his mind what would happen if it died and the storm failed to abate. But what was the use of leaving such plans to the last? If death seemed inevitable, would it not be better for him and Pai to meet it together, to slit their wrists and bleed to death side by side, rather than slowly freeze, pretending to the end that survival was plausible? He was ready to voice that suggestion now, while he still had the energy and focus to do so, but as he turned to the mistiff, some tremor reached him that was not the wind's tirade, but a voice beneath its harangue, calling him to stand up. He did so. The gusts would have blown him over had Pai not stood up with him, and his eyes would have missed the figures in the drifts, but the mistiff caught his arm, and, putting its head close to Gentle's, said,
"How the hell did they get out?"
The women stood 100 yards from them. Their feet were touching the snow, but not impressing themselves upon it. Their bodies were wound with cloth brought from the ice, which billowed around them as the wind filled it. Some held treasures, claimed from the glacier, pieces of their temple and ark and altar. One, the young girl whose corpse had moved Gentle so much, held in her arms the head of a goddess carved in blue stone. It had been badly vandalized. There were cracks in its cheeks, and parts of its nose and an eye were missing. But it found light from somewhere and gave off a serene radiance.
"What do they want?" Gentle said.
"You, maybe?" Pai ventured.
The woman standing closest to them, her hair rising half her height again above her head, courtesy of the wind, beckoned.
"I think they want us both to go," Gentle said.
"That's the way it looks," Pai said, not moving a muscle.
"What are we waiting for?"
"I thought they were dead," the mistiff said.
"Maybe they were."
"So we take the lead from phantoms?" "I'm not sure that's wise."
"They came to find us, Pai," Gentle said.
Having beckoned, the woman was turning slowly on her toe tips, like a mechanical Madonna that Clem had once given Gentle, which had played Ave Maria as it turned.
"We're going to lose them if we don't hurry. What's your problem, Pai? You've talked with spirits before."
"Not like these," Pai said. "The goddesses weren't all forgiving mothers, you know, and their rites weren't all milk and honey. Some of them were cruel. They sacrificed men."
"You think that's why they want us?"
"It's possible."
"So we weigh that possibility against the absolute certainty of freezing to death where we stand," Gentle said. It's your decision.
No. This one we make together. You've got 50% of the vote and 50% of the responsibility.
What do you want to do?
There you go again. Make up your own mind for once.
Pye looked at the departing women, their forms already disappearing behind a veil of snow. Then at Gentle, then at the Doekai, then back at Gentle.
I heard they eat men's balls.
So what are you worried about?
All right, the Mistiff growled. I vote we go.
Then it's unanimous.
Pye started to haul the Doekai to its feet. It didn't want to move, but the Mistiff had a fine turn of threat when pressed, and began to berate it ripely.
Quick or we'll lose them, Gentle said.
The beast was up now, and tugging on its bridle, Pye led it in pursuit of Gentle, who was forging ahead to keep their guides in sight. The snow obliterated the women completely at times, but he saw the beckoner glance back several times, and knew that she'd not let her foundlings get lost again. After a time their destination came in sight. A rock face, slate-grey and sheer, loomed from the murk, its summit lost in mist.
If they want us to climb, they can think again, Pye yelled through the wind.
No, there's a door,
Gentle shouted over his shoulder.
See it?
The word rather flattered what was no more than a jagged crack, like a bolt of black lightning burned into the face of the cliff. But it represented some hope of shelter, if nothing else. Gentle turned back to Pye.
Do you see it, Pye?
I see it, came the response. But I don't see the women.
One sweeping glance along the rock face confirmed the Mistiff's observation. They'd either entered the cliff or floated up its face into the clouds. Whichever, they'd removed themselves quickly.
Phantoms, Pye said fretfully.
What if they are?
Gentle replied.
They brought us to shelter.
He took the Doekai's rein from Pye's hands and coaxed the animal on, saying,
See that hole in the wall? It's going to be warm inside. Remember warm?
The snow thickened as they covered the last 100 yards until it was almost waist-deep again. But all three, man, animal, and Mistiff, made the crack alive. There was more than shelter inside. There was light. A narrow passageway presented itself, its black walls encased in ice, with a fire flickering somewhere out of sight in the cavern's depths. Gentle had let slip the Doekai's reins, and the wise animal was already heading away down the passage, the sound of its hooves echoing against the glittering walls. By the time Gentle and Pye caught up with it, a slight bend in the passage had revealed the source of the light and warmth it was heading towards. A broad but shallow bowl of beaten brass was set in a place where the passage widened, and the fire was burning vigorously in its centre. There were two curiosities, however. One, that the flame was not gold but blue. Two, that it burned without fuel, the flames hovering 6 inches above the bottom of the bowl. But oh, it was warm. The gobs of ice in Gentle's beard melted and dropped off. The snowflakes became beads on Pye's smooth brow and cheek. The warmth brought a whoop of pure pleasure to Gentle's lips, and he opened his aching arms to Pye O'Parr.
We're not going to die, he said. Didn't I tell you? We're not going to die.
The Mistiff hugged him in return, its lips first pressed to Gentle's neck, then to his face.
All right, I was wrong, it said. There, I admit it.
So we go on and find the women, yes?
Yes,
it said. A sound was waiting for them when the echoes of their enthusiasm died, a tinkling as of ice bells.
They're calling us,
Gentle said. The Doekai had found a little paradise by the fire, and was not about to move for all Pye's attempts to tug it to its feet.
Leave it a while,
Gentle said, before the Mistiff began a fresh round of profanities.
It's given good service. Let it rest. We can come back and fetch it later.
The passage they now followed not only curved, but divided many times, the roots all lit by fireballs. They chose between them by listening for the sound of the bells, which didn't seem to be getting any closer. Each choice, of course, made the likelihood of finding their way back to the Doekai more uncertain.
This place is a maze, Pye said,
with a touch of the old unease creeping back into its voice.
I think we should stop and assess exactly what we're doing.
Finding the goddesses. and losing our transport while we do it. We're neither of us in any state to go much farther on foot.
I don't feel so bad, except for my hands. He raised them in front of his face, palm up.
They were puffy and bruised, the lacerations livid.
I suppose I look like that all over. Did you hear the bells? They're just around the corner, I swear.
They've been just around the corner for the last 3/4 of an hour. They're not getting any closer, Gentle. It's some kind of trick. We should go back for the animal before it's slaughtered.
I don't think they shed blood in here, Gentle replied.
The bells came again.
Listen to that. They are closer.
He went to the next corner, sliding on the ice.
Pie! Come look!
Pie joined him at the corner. Ahead of them, the passageway narrowed to a doorway.
What did I tell you?
Gentle said, and headed onto the door and through it. The sanctum on the other side wasn't vast, the size of a modest church, no more, but it had been hewn with such cunning it gave the impression of magnificence. It had sustained great damage, however. Despite its myriad pillars, chased by the finest craft, and its vaults of ice-sleek stone, its walls were pitted, its floor gouged. Nor did it take great wit to see that the objects that had been buried in the glacier had once been part of its furniture. The altar lay in hammered ruins at its centre, and among the wreckage were fragments of blue stone, matching that of the statue the girl had carried. Now, more certainly than ever, they were standing in a place that carried the marks of Hapexamendios's passing.
In his footsteps, Gentle murmured.
Oh, yes, Pie murmured. He was here.
And so were the women, Gentle said. But I don't think they ate men's balls. I think their ceremonies were more loving than that.
He went down on his haunches, running his fingers over the carved fragments.
I wonder what they did. I'd like to have seen the rites.
They'd have ripped you limb from limb.
Why?
Because their devotions weren't for men's eyes.
You could have got in, though, couldn't you?
Gentle said.
You would have been a perfect spy. You could have seen it.
It's not the seeing, Pie said softly. It's the feeling.
Gentle stood up, gazing at the mischief with new comprehension.
I think I envy you, Pie, he said. You know what it feels like to be both, don't you? I never thought of that before.
Will you tell me how it feels, one of these days? You'd be better off finding out for yourself, Pie said.
And how do I do that?
This isn't the time.
Tell me.
Well, mischiefs have their rights, just like men and women. Don't worry, I won't make you spy on me. You'll be invited, if that's what you want.
The remotest twinge of fear touched Gentle as he listened to this. He'd become almost blasé about the many wonders they'd witnessed as they travelled, but the creature that had been at his side these many days remained, he realised, undiscovered. He'd never seen it naked since that first encounter in New York, nor kissed it the way a lover might kiss, nor allowed himself to feel sexual towards it. Perhaps it was because he'd been thinking of the women here and their secret rites, but now, like it or not, he was looking at Pi O Pa and was aroused. Pain diverted him from these thoughts, and he looked down at his hands to see that in his unease he'd made fists of them and reopened the cuts in his palms. Blood dropped onto the ice underfoot, shockingly red. With the sight of it came a memory he'd consigned to the back of his head.
What's wrong? Pi said.
But Gentle didn't have the breath to reply. He could hear the frozen river cracking beneath him, and the howl of the Unbeheld's agents wheeling overhead. He could feel his hand slamming, slamming, slamming against the glacier, and the thorns of ice flying up into his face. The mischief had come to his side.
Gentle? It said, anxious now. Speak to me, will you? What's wrong?
It put its arms around Gentle's shoulders, and at its touch Gentle drew breath.
The women,
he said.
What about them?
It was me who freed them.
How?
Numa, how else?
You undid the Unbeheld's handiwork?
The mischief said, its voice barely audible.
For our sake, I hope the women were the only witnesses.
There were agents, just as you said there'd be. They almost killed me. But I hurt them back.
This is bad news.
Why? If I'm going to bleed, let him bleed a little too.
Apexamendios doesn't bleed.
Everything bleeds, Pi. Even God. Maybe especially God. Or else why did he hide himself away?
As he spoke, the tinkling bells sounded again closer than ever, and glancing over Gentle's shoulder, Pi said,
"She must have been waiting for that little heresy."
Gentle turned to see the beckoning woman standing halfway in shadow at the end of the sanctum. The ice that still clung to her body hadn't melted, suggesting that, like the walls, the flesh it was entrusted upon was still below zero. There were cobs of ice in her hair, and when she moved her head a little, as she did now, they struck each other and tinkled like tiny bells.
"I brought you out of the ice," Gentle said, stepping past Pi to approach her.
The woman said nothing.
"Do you understand me?"
Gentle went on.
"Will you lead us out of here? We want to find a way through the mountain."
The woman took a step backwards, retreating into the shadows.
"Don't be afraid of me,"
Gentle said.
"Pi, help me out here."
"How?"
"Maybe she doesn't understand English."
"She understands you well enough."
"Just talk to her, will you?"
Gentle said. Ever obedient, Pi began to speak in a tongue Gentle hadn't heard before, its musicality reassuring even if the words were unintelligible. But neither music nor sense seemed to impress the woman. She continued to retreat into the darkness, Gentle pursuing cautiously, fearful of startling her, but more fearful still of losing her entirely. His additions to Pi's persuasions had dwindled to the basest bargaining.
"One favour deserves another," he said.
Pi was right. She did indeed understand. Even though she stood in shadow, he could see that a little smile was playing on her sealed lips.
"Damn her," he thought. "Why wouldn't she answer him?"
The bells still rang in her hair, however, and he kept following them even when the shadows became so heavy she was virtually lost among them. He glanced back towards the mystiff, who had by now given up any attempt to communicate with the woman and instead addressed Gentle.
"Don't go any further,"
it said. Though he was no more than 50 yards from where the mystiff stood, its voice sounded unnaturally remote, as though another law besides that of distance and light held sway in the space between them.
"I'm still here. Can you see me?" he called back,
and gratified to hear the mystiff reply that it could, he returned his gaze to the shadows. The woman had disappeared, however. Cursing, he plunged on towards the place where she'd last stood, his sense that this was equivocal terrain intensifying. The darkness had a nervous quality, like a bad liar attempting to shoo him off with shrugs. He wouldn't go. The more it trembled, the more eager he became to see what it was hiding. Sightless though he wasn't blind to the risk he was taking. Minutes before, he'd told Pi that everything was vulnerable, but nobody, not even the unbeheld, could make darkness bleed. If it closed on him, he could claw at it forever and not make a mark on its hideless back. He heard Pi calling behind him now.
"Where the hell are you?"
The mystiff was following him into the shadows, he saw.
"Don't come any further," he told it.
"Why not?
I may need a marker to find my way back."
"Just turn around."
"Not till I find her,"
Gentle said, forging on with his arms outstretched. The floor was slick beneath him, and he had to proceed with extreme caution. But without the woman to guide them through the mountain, this maze might prove as fatal as the snows they'd escaped. He had to find her.
"Can you still hear me?"
he called back to Pi. The voice that told him yes was as faint as a long-distance call on a failing line.
"Keep talking,"
he yelled.
"What do you want me to say?
Anything. Sing a song. I'm tone deaf. Talk about food, then."
"All right," said Pi. "I already told you about the ugga chi and the belly full of eggs."
"It's the foulest thing I ever heard,"
Gentle replied.
"You'll like it once you taste it,"
as the actress said to the bishop.
He heard Pi's muted laughter come his way. Then the mystiff said,
"You hated me almost as much as you hated fish, remember? And I converted you."
"I never hated you."
"In New York you did?"
"Not even then. I was just confused. I'd never slept with a mystiff before. How did you like it?
It's better than fish, but not as good as chocolate.
What did you say?
I said,
gentle, I can hardly hear you.
I'm still here,
he replied, shouting now.
I'd like to do it again sometime, Pye.
Do what? Sleep with you.
I'll have to think about it. What do you want, a proposal of marriage? That might do it.
All right, Gentle called back.
So marry me.
There was silence behind him. He stopped and turned. Pye's form was a blurred shadow against the distant light of the sanctum.
Did you hear me?
He yelled.
I'm thinking it over.
Gentle laughed, despite the darkness and the unease it had wrung from him.
You can't take forever, Pye,
he hollered.
I need an answer in...
He stopped as his outstretched fingers made contact with something frozen and solid.
Oh, shit! What's wrong? It's a fucking dead end, he said,
stepping right up to the surface he'd encountered and running his palms over the ice.
Just a blank wall!
But that wasn't the whole story. The suspicion he'd had that this was nebulous territory was stronger than ever. There was something on the other side of this wall, if he could only reach it.
Make your way back,
he heard Pye entreating.
Not yet,
he said to himself, knowing the words wouldn't reach the mischief. He raised his hand to his mouth and snatched an expelled breath.
Did you hear me, Gentle?
Pye called. Without replying, he slammed the pneuma against the wall, a technique his palm was now expert in. The sound of the blow was swallowed by the murk, but the force he unleashed shook a freezing hail down from the roof. He didn't wait for the reverberations to settle, but delivered a second blow, and a third, each impact opening further the wounds in his hand, adding blood to the violence of his blows. Perhaps it fueled them. If his breath and spittle did such service, what power might his blood contain? Or his semen? As he stopped to draw a fresh lungful, he heard the mischief yelling and turned to see it moving towards him across a gulf of frantic shadow. It wasn't just the wall and the roof above that was shaken by his assault. The very air was in a furor, shaking Pye's silhouette into fragments. As his eyes fought to fix the image, a vast spear of ice divided the space between them, hitting the ground and shattering. He had time to raise his arms over his face before the shards struck him, but their impact threw him back against the wall.
"You'll bring the whole place down!"
he heard Pye yell, as new spears fell.
"It's too late to change our minds," Gentle replied.
"Move, Pye!"
Light-footed, even on this lethal ground, the mischief dodged through the ice towards Gentle's voice. Before it was even at his side, he turned to attack the wall afresh, knowing that if he didn't capitulate very soon, they'd be buried where they stood. Snatching another breath from his lips, he delivered it against the wall, and this time the shadows failed to swallow the sound. It rang out like a thunderous bell. The shockwave would have pitched him to the floor, had the mischief's arms not been there to catch him.
"This is a passing place,"
it yelled.
"What does that mean?"
"Two breaths this time," was its reply. "Mine as well as yours, in one hand. Do you understand me?"
"Yes."
He couldn't see the mischief, but he felt it raise his hand to its mouth.
"On a count of three," Pye said. "One."
Gentle drew a breathful of furious air.
"Two."
He drew again, deeper still.
"Three."
And he expelled it, mingled with Pye's into his hand. Human flesh wasn't designed to govern such force. Had Pye not been beside him to brace his shoulder and wrist, the power would have erupted from his palm and taken his hand with it. But they flung themselves forward in unison, and he opened his hand the instant before it struck the wall. The roar from above redoubled, but it was drowned out moments later by the havoc they'd wrought ahead of them. Had there been room to retreat, they'd have done so. But the roof was pitching down a fusillade of stalactites, and all they could do was shield their bare hands and stand their ground, as the wall stoned them for their crime, knocking them to their knees as it split and fell. The commotion went on for what seemed like minutes, the ground shuddering so violently they were thrown down yet again, this time to their faces. Then, by degrees, the convulsion slowed. The hail of stone and ice became a drizzle, and stopped, and a miraculous gust brought warm wind to their faces. They looked up. The air was murky, but light was catching glints off the daggers they lay on, and its source was somewhere up ahead. The mistiff was first to its feet, hauling Gentle up beside it.
"A passing place," it said again.
It put its arm around Gentle's shoulders, and together they stumbled towards the warmth that had roused them. Though the gloom was still deep, they could make out the vague presence of the wall. For all the scale of the upheaval, the fissure they'd made was scarcely more than a man's height. On the other side it was foggy, but each step took them closer to the light. As they went, their feet sinking into a soft sand that was the colour of the fog, they heard the ice bells again and looked back, expecting to see the woman following. But the fog already obscured the fissure and the sanctum beyond, and when the bells stopped as they did moments later, they lost all sense of direction.
"We've come out into the Third Dominion," Pi said. "No more mountains? No more snow? Not unless you want to find your way back to thank them."
Gentle peered ahead into the fog.
"Is this the only way out of the fourth?"
"Lord, no," said Pi. "If we'd gone the scenic route, we'd have had the choice of 100 places to cross. But this must have been their secret way, before the ice sealed it up."
The light showed Gentle the mistiff's face now, and it bore a wide smile.
"You did fine work," Pi said. "I thought you'd gone crazy."
"I think I did, a little," Gentle replied.
"I must have a destructive streak.
Apex Amendios would be proud of me."
He halted to give his body a moment's rest.
"I hope there's more than fog in the third."
"Oh, believe me, there is. It's the Dominion I've longed to see more than any other, while I've been in the fifth. It's full of light and fertility. We'll rest, and we'll feed, and we'll get strong again. Maybe go to Limby and see my friend Skopeek. We deserve to indulge ourselves for a few days before we head for the second and join the Lenten Way."
"Will that take us to his Orderix?"
"Indeed it will," Pi said, coaxing Gentle into motion again. "The Lenten Way is the longest road in the Imagica. It must be the length of the Americas and more."
"A map," said Gentle. "I must start making that map."
The fog was beginning to thin, and with the growing light came plants, the first greenery they'd seen since the foothills of the Jokalelau. They picked up their pace as the vegetation became lusher and scented, calling them on to the sun.
"Remember, Gentle," Pi said when they'd gone a little way, "I accepted."
"Accepted what?" Gentle asked.
The fog was wispy now. They could see a warm, new world awaiting them.
"You proposed, my friend. Don't you remember?"
"I didn't hear you accept."
"But I did,"
the mistiff replied, as the verdant landscape was unveiled before them.
"If we do nothing else in this dominion, we should at the very least get married."
Chapter 24. 1. England saw an early spring that year, with the days becoming balmy at the end of February, and by the middle of March warm enough to have coaxed April and May flowers forth. The pundits were opining that if no further frosts came along to kill the blooms and chill the chicks in their nests, there would be a surge of new life by May, as parents let their fledglings fly and set about a second brood for June. More pessimistic souls were already predicting drought, their divining dampened when, at the beginning of March, the heavens opened over the island. When, on that first day of rain, Jude looked back over the weeks since she'd left the Godolphin estate with Oscar and Dowd, they seemed well occupied. But the details of what had filled that time were at best sketchy. She had been made welcome in the house from the beginning, and was allowed to come and go whenever it pleased her to do so, which was not often. The sense of belonging she'd discovered when she'd set eyes on Oscar had not faded, though she had yet to uncover its true source. He was a generous host, to be sure, but she'd been treated well by many men and not felt the devotion she felt now. That devotion was not returned, at least not overtly, which was something of a fresh experience for her. There was a certain reserve in Oscar's manner and a consequent formality in their exchanges which merely intensified her feelings for him. When they were alone together, she felt like a long-lost mistress miraculously returned to his side, each with sufficient knowledge of the other that overt expressions of affection were superfluous. When she was with him in company, at the theatre, or at dinner with his friends, she was mostly silent and happily so. This, too, was odd for her. She was accustomed to volubility, to handing out opinions on whatever subject was at issue, whether said opinions were requested or even seriously held. But now it didn't trouble her not to speak. She listened to the tittle-tattle and the chat, politics, finance, social gossip, as to the dialogue of a play. It wasn't her drama. She had no drama, just the ease of being where she wanted to be, and with such contentment to be had from simply witnessing, there seemed little reason to demand more. Godolphin was a busy man, and though they spent some portion of every day together, she was more often than not alone. When she was, a pleasant languor overcame her, which contrasted forcibly with the confusion that had preceded her coming to stay with him. In fact, she tried hard to put thoughts of that time out of her mind, and it was only when she went back to her flat to pick up belongings or bills, which, on Oscar's instruction, Dowd paid, that she was reminded of friends whose company she was at present not disposed to keep. There were telephone messages left for her, of course, from Klein, Clem, and half a dozen others. Later there were even letters, some of them concerned for her health, and notes pushed through her door asking her to make contact. In the case of Clem, she did so, guilty that she'd not spoken to him since the funeral. They lunched near his office in Marylebone, and she told him that she'd met a man and had gone to live with him on a temporary basis. Inevitably, Clem was curious. Who was this lucky individual? Anyone he knew? How was the sex? Sublime or merely wonderful? And was it love? Most of all, was it love? She answered as best she could, named the man and described him, explained that there was nothing sexual between them as yet, though the thought had passed through her mind on several occasions, and as to love, it was too soon to tell. She knew Clem well and could be certain that this account would be public knowledge in 24 hours, which suited her fine. At least with this telling she delayed her friend's fears for her health. "So when do we get to meet this paragon?" Clem asked her as they parted. "In a while," she said. "He's certainly had quite an effect on you, hasn't he?" "Has he? You're so, I don't know the word exactly, tranquil, maybe? I've never seen you this way before." "I'm not sure I've ever felt this way before." "Well, just make sure we don't lose the Judy we all know and love, huh?" Clem said. "Too much serenity's bad for the circulation. Everybody needs a good rage once in a while." The significance of this exchange didn't really strike her until the evening after, when, sitting downstairs in the quiet of the house, waiting for Oscar to come home, she realized how passive she'd become. It was almost as if the woman she'd been, the Jude of furies and opinions, had been shed like a dead skin. And now, tender and new, she had entered a time of waiting. Instruction would come, she assumed. She couldn't live the rest of her life so becalmed. And she knew to whom she had to look for that instruction, the man whose voice in the hall made her heart rise and her head light. Oscar Godolphin. If Oscar was the good news that those weeks brought, Cutner Dowd was the bad. He was astute enough to realize, after a very short time, that she knew far less about the Dominions and their mysteries than their conversation at the retreat had suggested. And far from being the source of information she'd hoped he'd prove, he was taciturn, suspicious, and on occasion rude, though never the last in Oscar's company. Indeed, when all three of them were together, he lavished her with respect. Its irony lost on Oscar, who was so used to Dowd's obsequious presence, he barely seemed to notice them.